Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Of China on the White House lawn, but the diplomatic pleasantries of the Chinese president's first official visit to the U.S. were interrupted by a protester. That protester somehow found her way into the press corps and called for the Chinese government to stop persecuting the banned Falun Gong religious movement. Her heckling continued for some time before security guards took her away. Well, we're joined now by Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, that protester who heckled President Hu was speaking Chinese, as we heard, and also speaking some heavily accented English. What do we know about her? What was she saying?
Well, she was urging President Bush to stop President Hu from killing people. That's as much as we can gather. We're also told that she actually had entered as a member of the press. On these kinds of visits, there are all sorts of foreign press that are enter the White House grounds with a temporary pass, and it seems that she had one of those and was standing with members of the press when she started screaming at the Chinese president.
It seems pretty incredible that someone would get that close to two world leaders at the White House.
You know, it does seem strange to believe, but the White House is relatively open as a matter of policy to press coming in. And of course, everyone has to go through security checks in terms of metal items they may be carrying. But in terms of getting one of these temporary cards, it's really not difficult.
Well, let's move to the day. And can you just tick through a laundry list of what's on the agenda of this visit for us and what the White House has said so far?
It is a very long list. They obviously are talking a lot about trade and economic issues, especially about the trade imbalance, about the Chinese currency, and about strengthening trade ties. But the key things here are security, and the security agendas don't match up. From the American side, the president wants to talk about Iran, North Korea, and to some extent Darfur as well. The Chinese really want to talk about one security thing that they always want to talk about, which is Taiwan.
And what do they want to say about that? How do they want that conversation to go?
Well, both sides, as is traditional with these sessions with the Chinese and the Americans, use key words, key phrases that push the right buttons for the other side. So the Chinese wanted to hear the president say, as he always says, the three communiques, the one China. These are what the Chinese have taken as a commitment to stopping Taiwan from breaking free. And that's exactly what the president said and what the President Hu also repeated. And on the other side, President Bush used the phrases that have become key terms in the relationship from the Bush administration's point of view. One is stakeholder, a phrase that the Bush administration has come up with and actually the Chinese find difficult to translate. The other thing is the peaceful rise. This is how the Chinese like to describe their own emergence as a great power looking forward. Peaceful rise meaning not threatening to countries like America.
Well, I want to ask you about that. You said the phrase stakeholder, and the Chinese have trouble understanding that. You know, the Chinese have obviously become very sophisticated in the ways of America. We know that they spent millions of dollars on lobbyists, on American lobbyists, when they were trying to purchase Unocal, American oil interest. But on the other hand, we read that Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick says that when the administration asked the Chinese in a speech to become a responsible stakeholder and tackle broader international concerns, you know, as any great power would, instead of just dealing with trade, the Chinese were perplexed. They didn't know if that was they didn't know what that meant.
Yeah, they didn't know whether it was positive or negative. And, of course, they didn't understand it as well because it's a very figurative term. And they tried to translate it initially as in a literal way. You're holding a stake. A piece of wood, is that? An investment? I mean, it's come to be something we understand in political jargon and public policy jargon, but it doesn't translate very easily. And there was an amount of back channel diplomacy to reassure the Chinese that this wasn't really critical. It was encouraging. It had an edge, of course. And what they mean is that they would like China, the Bush administration would like China to shed its neutral position on some of these very difficult international debates, especially about Iran and North Korea.
And we're going to talk about those in just a second. But in the few seconds we have with you, we also understand from a Washington Post article that President Bush told President Hu in a phone conversation that he thought he was a strong leader doing a good job. And as the Post reports, Bush says that to very many people. But but Mr. Hu took that very seriously.
Yeah, they do. And you know, I think they're looking for that kind of recognition and respect. And I think it's easily overlooked by the Bush administration just how important these small things are. And actually, it was important that the president encouraged President Hu today to overcome and to talk beyond the protester. He said, "You're doing okay."
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent with Newsweek magazine. He joined us on the phone from his office in Washington. Richard, thank you.
Anytime.
Well, for more analysis on how China is emerging as a major player on the world political stage, we turn now to Nayan Chanda, a longtime China watcher and former editor of the Far East Economic Review. He's now director of publications at the Yale University Center for the Study of Globalization. And Nayan, this issue of China's growing political power has really taken center stage on this visit. But with all of its domestic problems, how much global clout outside of trade does China really have?
It does have power in the region, and in some cases really rivaling U.S. influence.
Probably because of the huge economic power that it has.
Economic power that it has, and China's growing military power. China is there in the region, and United States is very far away, and now much more consumed in the Middle East than with the Far East. So the countries see that China is there to stay, and China is growing and more powerful. So we better listen to what China says.
So Iran and North Korea, we know, will be foremost on the agenda. Let's take Iran first. China has frequently sided with Russia in pushing back against U.S. pressure to deter Iran's nuclear program. What will the U.S. be asking China to do regarding Iran?
I think the U.S. would be asking China to full-heartedly support the U.S. position that Iran should be taken to task for its violation of the NPT. But the problem is that the Chinese have signed a $70 billion natural gas deal with Iran, and China is trying to lock up energy resources for the coming decades, and Iran is a major player as far as China is concerned in meeting that growing energy demand.
So what does the U.S. have to say to convince China that Iran might be a problem even for China?
Yeah, I think the U.S. will be saying that this is very bad for the region, because once Iran is allowed to have nuclear weapon capability, then you are going to see other countries trying to do the same thing. And certainly the possibility of a conflagration in the Middle East rises exponentially with the Iranian nuclear program. And since Chinese oil supply comes most of it from Middle East, China is going to be affected by any instability in the region as a result of Iranian program.
It will directly affect Chinese interests if the cost of crude oil skyrockets because of instability in that area.
Yes.
Well, North Korea seems even trickier for China. It's right there on the border. What are U.S. officials asking China to do regarding North Korea?
If the Chinese would stop their supply line of fuel and food to North Korea, that country would be in big trouble.
They're North Korea's biggest economic and political patron, we understand.
Absolutely. China has this dual issue. On the one hand, Chinese do indeed not want North Korea to go nuclear. On the other hand, North Korea is a socialist regime on the border, especially the only buffer between the capitalist South Korea and the U.S. bases in South Korea. They don't want North Korea to melt away. So how do you protect North Korea at the same time and not let it have nuclear weapons?
And when you say, you know, they don't want North Korea to melt away, do you mean to remove the buffer between China and South Korea?
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm imagining, too, that if North Korea falls and falls into huge domestic problems, that's not going to be good for China either.
No, because Chinese are really worried about a massive refugee flow that would result from a collapse of North Korea. Already China has tens of thousands of North Korean refugees, and a collapse of North Korea and perhaps takeover by the South would cause a huge flow of migrants to China.
Yeah. Isn't this a tricky slope that the U.S. is navigating, asking China to use more of its clout politically regarding Iran and North Korea? Because, you know, China's traditionally been more concerned with its own domestic problems. Might the U.S. regret at some point pushing China to flex its what could be a huge political muscle around the world?
Well, I think that it is being asked to exercise muscle only in areas where the U.S. lack muscle, you know. So
yeah.
It is not to compete with the United States, but only to support the United States' effort.
Well, I guess that's my question. How does one control that?
Yeah, I think it is always a double-sided sword, because the fact that the Chinese have some clout over North Korea, if that clout could be exercised to advance the goal of the United States foreign policy, that is good. But that clout can also be exercised other way around. And so by asking China to exercise clout on North Korea, U.S. is actually making North Koreans feel that they have no other option but to actually be nice to the Chinese, because Chinese have the possibility of handing the over to the United States. Mm.
We know the U.S. is also hoping that China can help in other areas, the Darfur region in Sudan, Burma, which has a military dictatorship. And we're going to talk in a moment about, you know, of course, there's human rights activists hoping that the Bush administration will push China on those issues as well. But I just want to ask you, before we let you go, you're at Yale, and Yale has been in the news connected with Hu Jintao's visit. He'll be visiting your campus tomorrow and actually just gave Yale permission to trade in China's securities market. That's the first foreign university to have that access. How'd that relationship come about?
Well, Yale actually has had the first Chinese student ever to come to the United States. And the Yale-China connection is very, very old. With the rise of Chinese economy, more Chinese students can actually afford to come to the United States. And there is a growing component of Chinese students here, and also Chinese researchers from many institutions are coming in a large number to Yale. Lawyers are being trained here in the Yale Law School in different aspects of free market economy. So Yale has been playing a key role in actually pushing China towards a more modern economy.
Are these relationships, not just at Yale but at other schools, and coupled with the huge trade relationships that are growing up between U.S. and Chinese businesses, are these one of the reasons that, you know, back to China's global political power, one of the reasons that there doesn't seem that much concern, at least as there used to be, about China's military aspirations?
Well, the concern is very much there at the Pentagon. The media, perhaps, there's much less. Pentagon is moving a huge amount of forces toward Asia. So I think the U.S. military planning is very much concerned about China's rise and China's military growth. Official Chinese defense budget is $35 billion, but actually people believe that it could be double that. So the U.S. is concerned, but it doesn't show so much in the public media.
Hmm. Nayan Chanda, former editor of the Far East Economic Review and director of publications at Yale's Center for the Study of Globalization. Nayan Chanda, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, well, what about human rights? A Falun Gong protester, as we said, showed up on the White House lawn today. We'll hear from an evangelical Christian who wants to put China's treatment of North Korean dissidents front and center as well. That's coming up. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Rights issues with Chinese President Hu Jintao at today's White House meeting. China's record on human rights was once the top priority for Washington, but with concerns over oil, Iran's nuclear program, and America's growing trade deficit with China, human rights seems to many to have taken a back seat. In fact, after Mr. Hu spoke to 5,000 Boeing employees in Washington State yesterday and promised to buy thousands of airplanes, a company executive stood up and proclaimed, "China rocks." Well, a group of evangelical Christians is working to get human rights back on the agenda in U.S. talks with China, and the plight of a missing North Korean woman could help them. Joining us for more on this is Deborah Fikes, executive director of the Midland Ministerial Alliance in President Bush's hometown of Midland, Texas. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Robin.
We mentioned that you're specifically focusing on the case of a 31-year-old North Korean woman who escaped from North Korea to China, and China ended up giving her back to North Korea, even as the U.S. thought it was negotiating with China to free her. Can you tell us more about this case? Who is this woman?
This woman, we know her as Kim Chun-hee, which is not her real name, but it's the name that she has assumed, and she is representing so many millions more in North Korea. We've been told that she is in her early 30s. She lost a child in North Korea that suffered from starvation, and that's really the best picture that we have because of the limited access that China gives us to the North Korean refugees.
Why is this one woman so important to evangelical Christians in your group in particular, and how are you leveraging your influence with the Bush administration to make changes?
I think Kim Chun-hee is important because she represents millions of others in North Korea that we don't have names for, even fake names to label them. So that's why we took a personal interest and wanted to leverage it as much as we could, not with the White House necessarily leveraging it. I don't know that that's a good term. We wanted media attention. We do know that President Bush is very concerned about the people of North Korea.
Well, the president did make a statement condemning China, but I want to ask you, with so many other issues in China, I'm looking at the Amnesty International page. They detail tens of thousands of Chinese detained and unfairly and probably tortured, thousands of Chinese sentenced to death, many after unfair trials. There's public protests against forcible evictions and land requisition. There's the crackdown on the Uyghur community, Falun Gong, the denial of freedom of expression in Tibet. Why choose North Korea to focus on?
Well, North Korea is more of an international issue because China is not honoring the international agreements that they have made. And refugees must be given international rights by the laws that are signed by China and other nations who belong to the UN. So this is something that is clearly defined, that refugees must have the access that the UNHCR has, and China denies that.
Well, in 2004, Congress passed the North Korean Human Rights Act, which created a special envoy for human rights in North Korea, but the administration hasn't set aside money to implement the law or offered asylum to any North Koreans. So do you feel the president, do you feel there's a commitment to this agenda?
I know he is committed to this agenda. There's no question in my mind, and I believe that we are close to seeing the possibility of North Korean refugees allowed into the United States.
Well, as you all know, critics of the U.S. say that it has its own problems in determining who's a refugee and who gets to come to the U.S. And China has also responded to the U.S. that the U.S. is applying a double standard on the issue of human rights, that in the wake of Abu Ghraib and the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, that the U.S. has lost some of its moral authority and has no right to question China.
Well, I don't want to discount any criticism about those particular cases where the United States definitely, there were huge mistakes as far as the treatment in Iraq with prisoners. And so any response needs to take that into consideration, that we also, American citizens and even the White House, condemned what happened in that particular situation, and people were held accountable. But there's no comparison when you look at the treatment that China gives North Korean refugees, even religious leaders. So I believe that that is just rhetoric from the Chinese government, that they want to deflect valid criticism of how they treat their citizens.
Well, Deborah Fikes, you have been able to be very effective in the past. Many people credit your group with forcing the administration to focus on the Darfur genocide in Sudan. But how much do you think human rights issues should drive U.S. foreign policy? Because some would say that maybe you flip it around and bring China in and do more trade with China and slowly change the country from within through, let's say, trade relationships, as opposed to beating them over the head with a stick of human rights violations.
My personal viewpoint is that both approaches are necessary, and it's important to be speaking out, but also to build relationships. President Hu, just on the White House lawn, was saying that people-to-people exchanges are important, and I agree with that, but I think we cannot compromise. When we take that other approach, we still have to say there are problems we need to address. Some of the groups that I work with are trying to find provinces and cities in China that have better human rights records, that allow more religious freedom, and highlight those areas and say, if you're an American corporation and you're thinking about opening a new business or expanding in China, find those provinces. Let's give credit where credit's due without compromising the areas that still have horrible human rights records, and they do exist in China.
Deborah Fikes, Executive Director of the Midland Ministerial Alliance in Midland, Texas, President Bush's hometown, hoping that he will focus more on human rights in his conversations today with the Chinese president. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, as the price of oil skyrockets and as we've been hearing, China is looking for more oil, oil companies are looking for new sources, like the sands of Alberta, Canada. But some critics say at what environmental cost. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Museum of
Boston's Cardinal Sean O'Malley says the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston needs to stop the bleeding. The church is struggling after years of scandal and debt. O'Malley says the Archdiocese faces a $46 million budget deficit, and he's released a flood of data detailing just how urgent the situation is. Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff is following the story. She joins us with more. Monica, in the wake of the clergy sex abuse scandal and the move here to close parishes, this archdiocese has been under a lot of pressure to release this information. So now that it has, what's been the reaction?
It's been pretty positive overall. Even the harshest critics of the archdiocese say the church has made a giant step forward in releasing such a detailed picture of their finances. Voice of the Faithful is a group that of lay Catholics that started here in Boston in a church basement at the height of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. And now it's working in parishes and dioceses across the country, trying to ensure this same level of financial transparency. The executive director of Voice of the Faithful, Ray Joyce, says what the Archdiocese of Boston released is a good model for the rest of the diocese in the nation to follow.
It's a new day here in Boston. We're excited about it, and we look forward to working with Cardinal O'Malley. This is what the laity has been asking for, is we need to know where the money is going. It is our money. And I think that's been a hot topic, particularly with the closing of the parishes.
And by the way, here in the Boston area, you know, we have listeners across the country, but here in the Boston areas, you can drive around and see huge banners outside of churches that people are trying to keep open. So this is a pretty contentious issue. The clergy sex abuse scandal is putting tremendous financial pressure on the archdiocese. It costs some $150 million so far to settle more than 800 claims. But as you mentioned, this is a national problem.
Yes, it is. Audited records for dioceses around the country show that this clergy sexual abuse crisis has cost the church in America more than $1 billion. And last year alone, it cost more than $450 million. And there are still hundreds of claims pending in Los Angeles, Portland, Oregon, Spokane, Washington. So it's not over by a long shot.
Right. We understand Los Angeles alone faces 500 claims. So other cardinals are watching closely. And Boston area parishioners are going to be getting pamphlets with some of the information that was released when the books were open, when they attend church this weekend, which has to be odd, you know, to open up your program and see that. But what about the timing? The annual fundraising effort for the Archdiocese is coming up, and you know, I'm wondering, are donations down?
Donations are down overall, and the timing of this really relates more to pressure from state legislators who were considering a bill last year that would have forced the Archdiocese of Boston and all religions to make this type of financial disclosure. So at that time, Cardinal O'Malley came out against that bill, and he said, we're going to do it on our own. But it is also tied to the fact that an important fundraising campaign is coming up, and O'Malley said yesterday that he's doing this to regain the trust of Catholics, that the one way to get out of this is for Catholics to trust him with their money and put it back in the collection basket.
And we should point out that some parishes are doing quite well. But others are millions of dollars in debt. As we said, Cardinal O'Malley has already closed more than 60 parishes. Do you think he's going to close more?
I say from reading this data, it's possible. I mean, some of these parishes, as you note, have fewer than 100 people attending Mass, take in only $60,000 a year, while others have 3,000 members, $1.5 million a year in donations. There's still a lot of inequity going on, and I think the Archdiocese is going to be forced to look at that issue again.
What about the issue of Catholic schools? As you know, and again, for the listeners outside the area, several have already been closed, and there's one case, for instance, where people in the neighborhood are trying to buy the school building back from the church. A lot of contention. What's the future of Catholic schools?
Well, the numbers don't look good in these reports for Catholic schools. It shows they're hemorrhaging money. And again, it's another area that the church, I think, is going to have to take a hard look at. They've set up a committee to do just that. They've made no announcements of any closing of schools or parishes. But when you look at their books, which they've opened for the first time ever, it's hard not to say there are going to be some hard choices to make.
We understand that they are also taking a hard look at seminaries. Well, what are they seeing there?
They're seeing that some are undersubscribed. Most are undersubscribed, at least in this area. One's doing well. Another is not doing so well financially. So there's also some reconsideration of where are they with the seminaries. What do they do to make them more financially stable?
Right. Well, and we're ticking through the problems here. There's a laundry list. One of the other major problems, pension funds for priests. It's underfunded by more than $100 million. That's got to have implications.
This is their biggest problem. You know, the Archdiocese said yesterday it's $46 million in debt. But in addition to that, its pension fund for priests is $135 million underfunded. And part of this is because for 17 years, money wasn't put into the pension fund. And there's really been no explanation from the Archdiocese as to why that happened. But in addition, they said yesterday the stock market is weak, and that's put additional pressure on it. The officials yesterday wouldn't say whether this could lead to pension cuts for priests, but the report did mention that they're going to have to put that on the table at least. I mean, this is what retired priests rely on, health, dental, and living expenses. And for many, it's about $2,000 a month. It's not a princely sum. So I know priests are very worried about this in the Archdiocese, and it's one of the biggest problems facing the church right now financially.
It opens up a lot of ugly pictures, of priests, not being able to take care of themselves in their older years. Well, the plan of the church, as we hear it, is to get out of the red in 18 months. Boy, when we hear these numbers, does that seem optimistic?
I think it seems optimistic. They've made, some suggestions of administrative cuts, 50 positions, reorganizing the cabinet. I think what this really relies on is, again, going back to Catholics in the pews, donating more money to the Archdiocese, that Cardinal Sean O'Malley hoping that this financial transparency will regain the trust of them to open up their wallets and help the church get out of this financial mess.
And I know there's one more person you want us to hear from, because some wonder if this is it. I mean, is there a guarantee that the clergy sex abuse scandal is over despite the settlements? I mean, may there be a future bill to pay?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in Los Angeles, they're looking at future bills, and many of these claims were opened up because the state changed the statute of limitation laws. In Massachusetts, the same thing might happen. And what was one or two lines in this many, many pages of documents said that the church is now substantially self-insured for the risks of clergy misconduct claims. This implies that it probably can't get or can't afford to pay for outside insurance. And that might be okay if there aren't any more sex abuse lawsuits waiting to happen. But there are three bills in the Mass state legislature that would lift the statute of limitations for criminal and civil sexual abuse of a minor. So Peter Borre, who's one of the main critics of the Archdiocese, points out that the future solvency of the church might rest on defeating these bills that would lift the statute of limitations and could create a new flood of cases.
If I were advising the Cardinal, I would say, as a financial analyst looking at this situation, that the biggest jeopardy to the finances of the Archdiocese today is not from gay marriage, it's not from gay adoption, it's not from financial disclosure. It is the possibility of lifting the statute of limitations and facing a third round of sexual abuse claims for which they appear to have no insurance.
So, Monica Brady-Meyerhoff, that brings the quick last question. Rome has got to be watching.
They are watching. It's the conventional wisdom is, as goes Boston, so goes the rest of the diocese in the country. But Cardinal O'Malley said yesterday, there will be no bailout from Rome. They're financially independent of each other.
Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Monica, thanks so much as always.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, tattoo artists in Oklahoma are one step closer to making a permanent mark on the state's constitution. Oklahoma is currently the only state in the country that bans tattooing. But on Monday, the State House of Representatives voted to legalize the practice, and that bill is now awaiting approval in the Senate. But tattoo artists had been practicing for a while anyway because of a loophole they discovered in the law. Tattoo artist Brandon Mull works at the Just Another Hole Parlor in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. He joins us on the line. And Brandon, do I understand that in 2000, you were arrested for just talking about tattoos?
Yeah, I was arrested in 2000 for talking about a tattoo with a young man, and the police came in and arrested myself and Dave Bennett, the owner of the shop at that time. We went to jail, and 4 hours later got out. So we went on for a while, and we're still tattooing. After that point, we just started tattooing in the hopes of getting arrested to see if we could challenge the law.
And then in 2003, you were arrested again and challenged the state's definition of a tattoo. Tell us about that.
We went to court and basically said that we were not guilty because the definition of the law is a tattoo is a permanent, indelible mark. With the technology that we have nowadays, a tattoo can be removed by many methods, laser being one of them, and laser also being the best. And the definition of indelible is also something that is unchanging. A tattoo, once it is put in the skin, the lines will spread out over many years. The colors will fade over years. So a tattoo is always changing once it's in the skin. So both of the words used to define the word tattooing don't really apply to what we do.
Aha. And the state apparently has given up and thrown in the towel because is thinking of changing the law, banning tattoos. Why do you think Oklahoma, I mean, tell us what about Oklahoma might have kept this law in the book so long?
Well, we actually had some senators down here and representatives quoted in the newspaper as saying that people with tattoos are immoral and tattoos are comparable to abortion. It's just ridiculous to think something like that. You know, I mean, I've got grandmothers and aunts and uncles I've tattooed on, you know, that were highly offended by those remarks.
Well, we understand that some of that anti-tattoo sentiment comes from what people feel are biblical injunctions against defiling your body.
The reference in Leviticus to the marking of the body, the word tattoo is only 250 years old. The word tattoo could not have been in the Bible because the Bible is obviously older than 250 years old. The reference to Leviticus, that is in the Old Testament. Jesus Christ died for our sins so that we don't have to live by the laws of God, which were the laws provided in Leviticus in the Old Testament.
Ooh, I had no idea that tattooing was going to take us down this road.
that is one of the, whenever that argument came up, that is what I always presented to them.
Another argument that's made against tattooing is that it's, there are hygiene problems and health problems.
Well, that is actually why tattooing became illegal in Oklahoma in 1963 in New York at Coney Island. There was an outbreak of hepatitis. Once upon a time, the same needle and tube were used on each person to get a tattoo. There was no changing of any kind of equipment. And they had basically a communal bucket for dipping the equipment in to rinse the inks off, which was full of blood and particles, you know,
okay,
stuff from many different people. Well, now there are universal precautions and standard, sterile procedures to go through. The equipment is disposable and is changed out for each person. So, that, you know, if someone is using the proper methods now, it's just as safe as going to a hospital or clinic or anything like that.
Well, in fact, proponents of tattooing say that making it legal makes it safer.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Well, the new bill also bans minors from getting tattoos and requires people under 18 to have parental consent before getting piercing. Do you think those are fair?
Oh, yeah, it, totally. There was an amendment in there to make it where no one under 18 could get a piercing at all. And we argued that would cause an epidemic of underage kids piercing themselves and ending up with scar tissue and infections. But I also have never had a policy of tattooing minors. I've always kept it, you know, you had to be 18 ever since I started tattooing.
Brandon Mull works at the Just Another Hole Tattoo Parlor in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. He's a supporter of a new bill there that, if approved by the Senate, would make tattooing legal in Oklahoma, the last state to ban the practice. And Brandon, before we let you go, what's your most requested tattoo?
Well, the butterflies are really requested, but there seems to be a lot of memorial tattoos here lately.
Yeah.
there's been a rise in crime here in Tulsa, and there's a lot of people that are losing family members, you know, due to many different things, and they're coming in to get, you know, tattoos to remember their, you know, their lost loved ones.
So a serious use for them of the tattoos. Brandon, thanks very much.
Have a nice day.
You're listening to Here and Now. By autism, a complex and bewildering neurological disorder that makes it difficult and sometimes impossible for the autistic to interact socially, depending where they are on a behavioral scale. Some problems are barely detectable. Some are devastating. Nearly 4,000 families across the country have two or more children with autism or related disorders. And while strides are being made to treat or lessen the effects of autism on autistic children, the parents and siblings also need help. A Family's Struggle is the subject of All Lost to Prayers, a musical being presented at the Boston Conservatory here in Massachusetts. Its co-creators were inspired by Shakespeare's The Tempest, especially the cowering, incommunicative character Caliban, to show the isolation and confusion that families can face. Composer Dana Brayton is here. Welcome, Dana.
Hello.
Along with Tom Evans, who wrote the libretto with Dana for the musical. Welcome.
Hi.
To you as well.
Nice to be here.
And Dana, Shakespeare's The Tempest, why?
I think because it deals with the idea of isolation, and we're both interested in thinking and talking about isolation.
And let's remind ourselves, The Tempest, we have the sorcerer Prospero and
right.
on the island with his daughter.
Right.
Caliban seemed to be the key. How so?
He has a couple of soliloquies. They have made-up words. It talks about his intimate detail of the things that exist on the island. Also his antisocialness and the idea that he didn't have language. It clicked.
Yeah.
And I said, this is it. This is how it has to happen.
And so with The Tempest as our springboard, you now have a single father, Richard, and his daughter Miranda living with an autistic child, Richard Jr. They're isolated, much like the characters in The Tempest.
Right.
Miranda is a young woman who resents the attention given to her brother Richard, whom she calls Dick, or worse. Here, let's listen to an excerpt from the play.
No, we can't go out, Miranda, because Dick won't wear his shoes when it rains. No, we can't go out because Dick will wander around snipping other people's food. No, we can't go out because Dickhead will get overstimulated and start a weather alert at full volume. No, Miranda, we can't do anything for you because Richard needs all the attention.
The families care very deeply for these kids, and there's moments when they connect to the kid, and it's very powerful and tender and loving. And there's other moments where it's so difficult. We got a call from a father who said basically it was his story. He had a 22-year-old son, and he would spend, he said, 364 days of year trying to convince him to take a shower more than once a week. And then suddenly one day the kid would talk to him in a very coherent, insightful, sort of brilliant way. And it's that struggle between, you can't write the kid off because there is something going on there, but at the same time it's so challenging to connect to and make that real connection that we're so used to. Even something as simple as eye contact, a lot of autistic kids won't establish any eye contact, so it's very very challenging.
Let's listen to a scene where we can see that helplessness in the father's character. He's trying to parent and provide and getting no response. Dana Brayton, I know you spoke to families. What did you find?
They have to enlist their help of their relatives. They form organizations where people with autistic sons help each other out. More recently, there are more social avenues for them to get help.
And by the way, you say you spoke to mothers with boys. We understand three times as many boys as girls have autism. And there is a boy in your work. And you did seem to get inside Richard Jr.'s head.
Danger, danger, weather alert. Dad, where are you?
This is Channel 5 Weather Alert. 1989, dangerous year. 50 killed by tornadoes. Big went the bag. Beep, 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 bad bleak boy. Beep, 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 bad bleak boy. Bump, thump, bump, thump. My thumper is banging. Raven rumble. Let there be fight, and there was fought. Boomerang raven rumble. Shall we give o'er and drown? You bawling, blasphemous, incharitable dog. T-E-M-P-E-S-T, Act 1, Scene 1.
Another scene from All Us to Prayers, a musical at the Boston Conservatory about a family with an autistic son. And there's the son, Tom, mimicking, saying something over and over again. How do you get inside an autistic's head to write a libretto for him?
Well, our character is very obsessed with weather, so we thought about a whole range of things that might have had to do with weather. So the Wizard of Oz, there's the big storm, so he might have picked something from that. Anything that he had heard might be something that he would repeat later. It didn't seem that hard to imagine a level of frustration. He comes home, his father isn't there, and he goes into his rituals to try to soothe himself. He repeats things that he's heard before. He's going back into things that are familiar because this situation coming home without his dad is so unfamiliar to him.
Dana, yours might be the first musical about autism in a family, although many would say the Who's Tommy, that the character Tommy is autistic in that as well. But are you at all worried? You know, families are so protective of these children. On the one hand, they have stress and they need help. On the other, they don't want people to think that their children are too much trouble. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And do you worry about presenting them?
I think that we tried to present the kind of weight that any kind of family would have to deal with a person that has a disability. It's a family under stress, and the issue is, how does the family survive? And therefore, I think although the Tempest is the vehicle and autism is what we're talking about, we're basically talking about a very basic family dynamic where autism is a manifestation of the family being under stress.
We got a call from a man whose son is very much like the character. You know, he had felt some isolation, even though he was a very well connected to the world of autism. I think he was grateful that there was a story out there, and it was a story that didn't have necessarily a all's better ending. You know, it's a difficult situation. It doesn't get all better. In our story, the family did find a way to work with each other, and that's something that's been important to us in a lot of our work, that the strength of the family, in a way, is the happy ending, but the kid doesn't magically get better.
Dana Brayton, Tom Evans, co-creators of All Lost to Prayers, a musical about a family struggling with autism. It's currently at the Boston Conservatory here in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you both so much for coming by.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Oil companies